唱歌，我就把
that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Tell me not that I'm a dreamer. For the things I feel and see, or that nothing can be accomplished from the things I wish to be. Tell me not that I'm fanatic for the things I feel inside. They are flowers of oppression, born of pain I cannot hide. Do not look upon my actions as the acts of one insane, when I take up modern weapons to avenge my father's name. Let your eyes scan all the ghettos through the books of history, then you'll understand this feeling and just how it came to be. Sure, I must admit I'm bitter for the precious blood I've bled and for the years of cruel oppression that you've heaped upon my head, for the rape of my grandmothers and the mulattoes that you have left, for the many, 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 many years of slavery with its legacy of death. Tell me not that I'm a dreamer. Oh no, it's you that cannot see. I am just another victim of a cruel reality. What manner of man is this, I ask, who roams the seven seas, who graces the skies and birds of on and wanders where he please, who walks into another's home and takes his property, then slays the man, his wife and child in the name of liberty? What manner of beast is this, I ask, who drops the napalm from the skies, then send my sons away to war to maim and kill and die? What manner of man is this, I ask, who arrogantly displays his might? What manner of man is this, my friend? Needless to say, he's white. So take your hands off of me, white folks. I've done you no wrong. I'm only guilty of making you strong. I've built all of your cities, and I've worked in your mines. I've fought to protect you many a time. It was I who taught you what it is to be brave. I had great civilizations when you lived in caves. I taught you what soap was when you dyed yourselves blue. I taught you planting and harvesting too. I showed you what clothes were to cover your backs when you were in wolf skins and running in packs. When you knew nothing of the barrier of sound, it was I who taught you that this planet was round. In Palermo, Sicily, and Italy, and Spain, I left monuments of my grandeur and fame. And during your dark ages, when your people were blind, I built universities to enlighten your kind. When your homeland was weak and your people were poor, it was I who brought you to America's shore. While you did not even know how to survive, I showed you medicine to keep you alive. How earnest you seemed, how well you did learn, how vile the reward I received in return. But time is on my side. I'm sure you must know that the day will arrive when you'll reap what you sow. For I gave you religion, and you know it's a fact that the Christ and the Buddha and Muhammad were black. I taught you to dance, and I taught you to sing. You repaid me with treachery, with slavery and chains. So don't touch me, Whitey, and don't look surprised. No, I'm no longer fooled by your tricks and your lies. I'm aware of your game and of your history, and I'm aware of the Judas that you have been to me. So watch out for me, white folks. It's a matter of time. I'll soon be together. Then vengeance is mine.
Hotep and greetings, my brothers and sisters. Welcome to the Black Reality Think Tank. I am William Rogers, and I am your host for this afternoon, this evening's program. We thank you for joining us. We are here every Tuesday evening from 8 to 10 p.m., and we are on Saturday afternoons from 4 to 6 on the Blog Talk Radio system. So I thank all of you for being here this evening. We have a wonderful and very stimulating program.
What do you want the world to know about Foster?
The program is...
he's a good man.
I'm sorry, just... we are here every... As I said, we are here every Tuesday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. We want to have a wonderful discussion this evening with a young lady. Her name is A Sister Story. Good afternoon, Ms. Story. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. How about yourself?
Wonderful. We'll be getting back to you in just a few minutes. But we are going to be talking with her today about a situation that is so very dominant in the African-American community, and that's sexual abuse and the Black family. Sexual abuse and the Black family. And that will be our discussion this afternoon, this evening. And she is going to tell us about a book that she has written addressing that issue, and just basically in general. You know, one of the things that we do here at the Black Reality Think Tank is we are always concerned about building the Black family. We are very, very, very intuitive about making sure we indicate to each other and help each other understand how do we need to do that. And we need to do that in many cases by addressing these very particular specific issues. And that's what we've tried to do here. We've had discussions on many aspects that impact the Black community. And so very clearly, we today, this discussion surely is one that embraces the Black family structure as well. And so we're real thankful. I'm real thankful for having Ms. Story to come on and tell us some things. So we'll be getting to her in just a few minutes. As you know, on each edition of the Black Reality Think Tank, we do a ancestral profile where we honor our ancestors. The famous quote that I always like to use by the great Fannie Lou Hamer, and that is, you always praise the bridges that brought you over. We must always praise the bridges that brought us over. So tonight I am going to do an ancestral profile on a wonderful sister. Her name is Jean Blackwell Hudson. Jean Blackwell Hudson. And Hudson is spelled H-U-T-S-O-N. H-U-T-S-O-N. Jean Blackwell Hudson. Miss Hudson was born, Jean Blackwell, Hudson is her married name, but she was born on September the 7th, 1914. She transitioned on February the 4th, 1998. She was an African-American librarian. She was an archivist, a writer, a curator, an educator. And in her later part of her life, she became the chief of the Schomburg Center for Research and Black Culture, located in New York City. And there she was able to help upgrade the library to what it is now. Mrs. Hudson was born in Somerville, Florida, and she was married to a gentleman whose name was Andy Razoff. That was her first husband from 1939 to 1947. And her last husband was John Hudson, 1950. To 1998. She had one adopted child, which whose name was Jean Francis, and she deceased in 1992. But as I said, Ms. Hudson was a librarian, curator, writer, and activist. Her degree was from Barnard College. She was one of the first African Americans to graduate from Barnard College, and she also had a master's in library science from Columbia University in New York as well. She was an elementary school teacher for a short period there, and she was able to embrace herself with history from some of that experience. But in 1931, Miss Hudson had gone to the Frederick Douglass High School, which is where she was a student, and she attended the school and was taught by two very famous individuals. She was taught by women who were the offspring of W.B. Du Bois and Kelly Miller. And she contributed a lot of what she wanted to do and learn from history from the influence of these two wonderful individuals. She enrolled in the University of Michigan. She had an intention of studying psychiatry, but due to the Depression period at the time, she had to switch gears and attend Barnard College in New York City. Ms. Hudson graduated in 1935 with a BA in English, being the second black female to graduate, with Zora Neale Hurston being the first. The following year, she graduated from Columbia School of Library, as I said, with a master's in library science. And during the midst of her life, Ms. Hudson managed work with several very important individuals who were in the latter parts of the Harlem Renaissance. Ms. Hudson first began her professional career as a high school librarian in Baltimore from 1936 to 1939, and also at several branches of the New York Public Library. She took an initiative to bring Spanish language literature to the school, so Spanish-speaking students had greater access to the library as well. Ms. Hudson had a huge role in the development of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black History. The Schomburg Center was actually previously called the 135th Street branch of the New York Public Library. But because of the work of Joel Schomburg and some of the others in bringing that collection, that very inclusive collection of material that documented the people of African descent and their history and their culture. And so while she worked as an educator, she was able to teach college as well. She was an adjunct professor at the City College of New York in history department, where she taught African-American history. She spent a great time as a librarian, balancing her time while she was writing many short stories and introductions for many different books. Ms. Hudson spent the year of 1939 as a New York public librarian, and in 1948 as the acting curator of the Division of Negro Literature and History and Prints at the 135th Street County Cullen Branch, that's what it was called before the Schomburg Center, of the New York Public Library in Harlem. She reported that her initial job was to keep the Negroes quiet for the first 6 months. During her tenure as the curator and then the chief of the Schomburg Collection for Research in Black Culture from 1948 to 1980, Hudson oversaw the growth of that collection, and it grew extensively. And it was able to, but in the original time, it was a part of a very inadequate, dilapidated building, which had been built very early in the beginning of the 20th century and had begun to crumble. And the books were getting damp. The library was damp. It had leaks in it. And very clearly, there needed to be something done to preserve this great collection. So for 8 years, Ms. Hurston dedicated her time to raise money to spread awareness about the Schomburg Collection. With Hudson's determination to shine light on the Schomburg, they began to receive private and New York City and state grants. In 1965, they received funding from the North Manhattan Project, which resulted in the Schomburg's first budgetary increase for the collection since 1948. The Schomburg Center also received a grant in 1967 from the Ford Foundation. The Schomburg received a lot of grants as well as recognition due to her commitment and dedication to her work. This collection became one of the main research libraries in the New York Public Library System in 1972. With a very special invitation, Kwame Nkrumah invited Ms. Hudson to come to Ghana to help him preserve some of the resources that they had there, and she was able to help him put in place a very big library system. So, Ms. Hudson, Jean Hudson, very dynamic lady, very important that the work that she did, if any of you have had an opportunity to visit the Schomburg, you would be amazed at the collection that's in there. You can go online and have a look at some of the things that they have. But it is the most extensive collection right now in America in reference to African-American life and culture. The Spingarn at Washington, D.C. is another system, but it has not been able to match the Schomburg that has been done now. So that is our profile for today. We were very happy to be able to bring that. And so we want to now begin our conversation and talk to our wonderful guests that we have. We have a sister story. Is her name. And she has written a book, and I'm going to now bring her on. Ms. Story, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, great, great. So again, I want to thank you so much for again to agreeing to come. This is a very critical topic. Again, we are talking about healing the Black family, and we want to do that. And this is an area of the Black family that we have got to heal, because it's at the root of some things that we know that has happened. So the title of our program today is Sexual Abuse and the Black Family. So why don't you tell Ms. Story, why don't you tell our listening audience a little bit about yourself, background, give us the name of your book, and let's begin with that. Ms. Story?
Yes, can you hear me? I'm sorry.
Yeah,
can you hear me?
I can hear you now, yes.
Okay. So a little bit a background about the book. It comes from, it's about 70 years. It's five generations of my family.
Okay.
It goes back five generations. And it specifically highlights, majority of it that it highlights is about sexual assault. And it talks about five generations of my family, how sexual assault was repeated throughout each generation. It first started with my great-great-great-grandfather, and it went down to his daughters, and their children, which would be to my mother, would be my mom's generation, from them to my generation. So far, it stopped at my generation, which is a blessing. And that's a little bit about the background about the book.
Okay. What area of the country did it begin? What area of the country are we talking about? Is it in the South, the North, Northeast? What part of the country?
It began down south, actually, south in Arkansas.
Great. Okay. All right. Good. That helps a lot. Understand that. So in that first generation that you wrote about, it was the institution of chattel slavery still in existence then, or was it post-slavery?
It was after. It was after slavery.
Okay, after slavery. So it's definitely Jim Crow, though, right?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Good enough. Tell us a little bit about yourself, maybe, and, what inspired you to sit down. I know it's very difficult to sit down and write some information and stuff about your family, particular things that hurt. So give us a little bit of background about yourself, and then what is the motivating factor that's made you say, I need to write this, I need to put this on paper?
A little bit of background about myself. So I'll give a little bit of my story from childhood a little bit.
Okay.
So I was sexually abused for 9 years, from about starting at 3 to 4 till age 12. I gave birth. I conceived a child through sexual assault, the person who was sexually abusing me since I was a child. I conceived when I was 12. I had him when I was 13 years old. I struggled a lot with mental health. Severely through my teenage years up until adulthood. I say it ended probably roughly about when I was 20, up until I was about 20 years old. I struggled from depression and PTSD. And at the time, I was really unsure about what I was going through and what I was experiencing, because I experienced a lot of gaslighting, which in my family, I was always told, oh, that's not true, you're making it up, what happens in this house is supposed to stay in this house, you're telling these white folks our business and this on, so on and so forth. And so, I was really confused. I grew up really confused. I didn't know if I could trust myself and, my own thoughts and the things that I thought and what I thought took place, and maybe it didn't take place, and then I knew it took place because I had a child, so I knew that part. I knew that part, wasn't something that I, made up in my head.
Right, exactly.
Since I was about 13, when I was about 13 years old, I actually was when I first started writing the story. Because I knew that, I would hear the stories that happened to the generation before me, and I would hear the adults talk about it, but my family, like, my mother, my grandmother, I would hear the secrets, that they would discuss amongst each other. Mm-hmm. And me being a child, you're not really supposed to be in a room with grown folks are talking or really be around, period. So I would be, hearing the stories like, oh my gosh. And by that time, I got about 13 years old. I could understand at least a little bit of what they were saying and what was going on and be able to place it together. So that's actually when I started writing.
Okay.
What really inspired me to write the story, when I was younger, I had a couple of friends who were also sexually abused. And we were children. One of them, she's still a dear friend now. And we were children at the time, so we didn't really understand what was going on. But I remember having conversations with my friends like, yeah, so-and-so touched me last night, or my cousin did this. And I remember going to school, and that was a conversation that I had amongst friends. So by the time I got older and got to be about 13 after I gave birth to my son, I was inspired to write the story because of the fact that I knew that I wasn't the only person going through it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is something, not to say it in a good way, that it, like I said, that I'm not the only person going through this, or in black households, because all my friends, they were black, that were telling me their story and the things that they went through, and as well as my family members. So I got the opportunity. I kept digging a little bit, kept fishing. And really, an uncle of mine, which is featured in the book, is the one who truly inspired me to write the book. And he was sexually abused for many, many, many years. He was sexually abused. And he ended up turning to homosexuality, drug addiction, and some other things because of the abuse that he went through. And so he would have been the fourth generation. So him being the fourth generation, you know, in my generation, I'm considered the fifth generation. Him being a fourth generation, and it passing down. So what happened to him was passed down just from the first generation, because my great-great-grandfather molested and you know, committed incest with his daughters and his stepchildren. And so their mothers left and moved up north, actually. So after that happened, they were down south in Arkansas. They got to an age where they could, you know, back then they were getting married when they were like 12, 13, 14. So they all got married and left. And so after they all got married and left, there were two of them who ended up marrying men who sexually abused their children. But the children that they had, they didn't have any daughters. They had boys. So they had sexually abused their boys, their sons. And then one of the people who sexually abused their son sexually abused my uncle. And then so on and so forth, and then it got to me. But like I said, what inspired me to write the story is because I knew that I was not the only black person that went through this. I knew that I wasn't the only black family that went through this.
Okay.
And it helped me be able to cope with the mental illness and the things that I was going through, because I was able to understand what truly happened and where it came from. Because my whole life, I was like, man, I'm so different. My life is like this. You know, I would have pity parties and feel sorry for myself and, you know, try to find different ways to cope. And so I found writing was my great escape. But I found that helped me. So writing the book at first, when I first wrote it, it kind of started off as a poem.
Mm-hmm.
And the poem ended up turning into a book because I let some people read it, and they were like, oh, my gosh, you need to figure out how to write screenplays. I was like, write a screenplay? This is just a poem. What do you mean, you know?
Right.
And so I ended up figuring it out, and I wrote a book, and I listened to some screenplay. I'm actually going to go and take a few courses, get a certificate in creative writing here soon. But I ended up turning it into a book. It's been pretty popular lately. And a lot of people, you know, it was really hard writing it because it's my family, as you said. It's not really a discussion, actually, that I've kind of had with them lately about it. They know it exists. But it was very, very hard. Writing, you know, parts that didn't really directly affect me,
mm-hmm.
It was hard writing it because I had to acknowledge, like, oh, my gosh, this happened to somebody. This is somebody's life. Like, this isn't a story that you just, you know, made up. This is something that really happened. And then, you know, by the time at the end of the book, it tells my portion, my part of the story. And by the time it got to me, you know, it took a lot to have to relive the things that I went through.
Hmm.
And that was the part of me where I was like, are you really ready for this?
Okay. You know,
because the different parts of me, you know, the part that showed up here today, you know, is different from, is not the person that got sexually abused for those 9 years and that endured that trauma. So I had to check in with her, like, hey, are you good today?
Right.
Can you handle this? Right. You know, because I was bringing up a part of me that I had let go a long time ago and had buried.
Right.
So it was really, really hard. It was really difficult.
Yeah. For our listening audience, Miss Story and I met a couple of months ago. We are both a part of a Facebook group called Black Writers and Thinkers. And she had put an excerpt of a book on the site. And I read it, and I was blown out of the water. So I text her right away. And say, I need to talk to you. Can we talk? And she did. She called me right away. I gave her my number. She called me. And we have been basically conversing since. It wasn't just so much about being on the program, but just understanding what, you know, it was, the dynamics of what she went through and what she's going through. And then obviously to have her come on and talk about it. Why don't you tell us the name of your book and maybe a little bit about how they can get a copy of it?
So the book is called Generational Curses, 70 Years of Destruction of a Black American Family. You can find it if you look me up on Facebook. I'm selling copies, or you can find it on Amazon. So it's Generational Curses, 70 Years of Destruction of a Black American Family. If you put Generational Curses, you'll find it. And it's by Asista Story, Asista Story. Because I know there's a book that's similar to it, but if you'll find it. If you remember my name, Asista Story, you'll be able to find it.
And I'm telling you, it's powerful. And once you read that, you'll also have an understanding of a lot of what she's, saying today. Okay, I want to ask her, get into it a little bit. You tell me, I'm going to look forward to your guidance and tell me when you want to go too deep or not deep enough, or either you might say, that's all I want to talk about. So I'm open.
Okay.
I'm open to all of that. You know, I just want to, get, because I think the key point here is to help others who are listening audience and those who know people that in our listening audience who know people that might be a part of something like that to look at this and how to heal. We have a therapist who's a frequent guest to the Black Reality Think Tank. She'll be coming on in a few minutes, and she's going to come on and talk from that healing perspective and understanding what that healing perspective does and what, you can do with that. So she'll be coming on in just a few minutes. But also, I want to ask you now, so that we can kind of get an understanding, in terms about you writing this book and obviously having to revisit this pain over and over again. In a situation like this in a Black family, how does the family function day to day with each other? In other words, you normally sometimes you get up in the morning, you either go to work or go to school. On Saturdays and Sundays, you get up, you go eat breakfast, you sit down, you talk, you have Christmas, you have holidays together. Is that still a part of the family activity to do those things, if all of this other stuff is going on in the shadows? How do we look at that, Ms. Story? Ms. Story, are you there? Hello, Ms. Story?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me? I'm sorry.
Yes, I hear you. Uh-huh. Okay.
Okay.
Did you hear the question?
Yes, I did. So a day-to-day, I would say looking at it, remembering, going back a little bit, I had a very dysfunctional family.
Okay.
Now, up until when my great-grandmother passed away, we did do family functions. We did do family reunions. I would say that probably all ended around the time I was about 8 to 10 years old. So we did go to family. We went to Sunday service together. We major holidays, Christmas, Thanksgiving, things like that.
Okay.
We were together. It always ended, though, with someone arguing or, fighting over something or, bickering. And a lot of the drama and chaos and the dysfunction came from the sexual assault.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the major people who played such a big role when it came as far as the dysfunction would have been my grandmother. So there wasn't that much love shown in my family, that I can remember. It was more so like, oh, now you're on drugs and you're like this. And it wasn't coming from a place to be like, how can I help you? What is it that you need? Let's get this problem fixed. Mm-hmm. It was more in an offensive way. It was in an offensive way.
Right.
And I just remember my grandma, talking about my mom and, talking about my uncles at the time. I really didn't understand the fact that he was sexually abused. I barely understood the fact that I was sexually abused.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was not a lot of love there. There was most definitely not a lot of love there. But we did do a lot of, like I said, family functions and things like that and holidays together, but it was very dysfunctional when we did do it.
Right. Okay. So, but you did have Christmas holidays and things like that you would celebrate as a family.
Correct.
Right. Okay, let me ask you, what about the alcohol and drugs? Was that anywhere in this? Were some of the victimizers alcoholics or were they involved in drugs or anything like that?
You said were the victimizers, you said?
Yeah, your microphone is seems like it's rattling up against
you. Breaking up on my end. It's breaking up a little bit, so it's kind of hard to understand what your question was. So if you just repeat it one more time for me.
Okay, we got some bad weather out here, so it might have a lot to do with that. But I'm saying, was alcohol and drugs involved among some of the people that were doing the victimizing? Was that a factor? Did that play into this whole thing?
I would say no. I would say no. That I know of, neither party, the people who participated in it, that they did not use any drugs or alcohol. I can say, though, as I got older, the person who, victimized me, they did use drugs and alcohol. Mm-hmm. But it was not until they got about 18, 19, 7. I would say about 17 to 19 years old.
Okay. All right, and the reason I ask that is because a lot of times, obviously in this discussion, you want to begin to look for reasons. What is the causes of some of this? And I wanted to go there first. So if that's not an issue, then let me ask you, from your perspective, the book, and obviously you're making the assessments and analysis of your life and your family's life, what would you begin to say would be a cause system here? What's going on? What did you see? What did you think? Are you driving?
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Are you driving in your car? Are you in your car?
I'm not. I'm out. I don't know if you can, I can hear you. I don't know if you can hear me.
It's like a wind. You're like somewhere the wind is blowing. And it's something.
It's blowing in. Yeah, it's blowing inside.
Okay.
Just one minute.
Okay.
Let me get away from where I'm at. I'm sorry.
That's right.
But go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm saying I wanted you to begin to speak to what you might think, the causation situation here. How do we begin to understand the cause? Because, obviously we know that this is about as abnormal as anything could ever be in life. So where's the cause? Because I guess if somebody is going to heal and they're going to be done healing done in the family, it would have to be some kind of consideration about what caused this. And where does that come from? Because obviously you have to have some challenges, in order to be involved in a situation like this. What do you think are the causes? How do you begin to look at that? How do you begin to address causes?
I think the thing that I can give it from my perspective, as you said.
Yeah, that's it. That's only your perspective.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. What'd you say?
No. I was just saying strictly your perspective. I'm not trying to get a professional
textbook.
Yeah, it's just your
I would say my perspective, I believe that everything happens in the spirit first.
Okay.
Before it's done here on earth or, carnally. And so when I look at it starting from my great-great-great-grandfather, I look at it as being his spirit was weak. And that's the most honest opinion that I could give you. Being that in the spirit when it comes to falling in temptation and lust,
right?
Because it's the only thing that could really grasp my mind into believing what would lead a man to want to have intercourse with his own daughters.
Right.
Or, you understand what I'm saying?
Oh, yes.
So it's the only thing that I could honestly wrap my mind around the situation and the fact and looking at it from then. Now, I can tell you the cause from it after that where it was due to individuals being sexually abused themselves. So afterwards, within that second generation, so within the second generation, the ones who molested or sexually abused someone after that, they were sexually abused.
Okay.
And that's been verified. So they were sexually abused.
Okay.
So everyone except for that first generation were sexually abused.
Okay. Gotcha. Okay. Now I'm not looking for excuses for anybody or anything like that. But I know you're talking Jim Crow South. You're talking obviously Arkansas. African women have always been abused. Men have been abused in that system. All beginning from the transatlantic slave trade, it was a consistent act of rape and sexual activity, even to the point of making it legitimate. I remember, and I have plenty of historical diaries and texts talk about that experience, and I'm sure it has to have some impact on the way people thought and dealt. You know, black women being raped and white men not being able to have to answer to any of that, just a consistent system. And that happened right on up through segregation, right on into post-segregation. Even today, black women are still being exploited in very big ways, you know. And so I think that in that kind of environment, has something to do with it. Now, whether it's a specific thing that relates to, situation, I'm not sure. That's where we'll ask our expert when I bring her on to maybe she can talk about and address that. Did they ever try to justify what they were doing in any ways to you? I don't know if there's much conversation that happened or, you know, when there was an attempt to confront those that were victimizing you. Was there some kind of a justification that they were using? What were they saying? Why I'm doing this? Ain't nothing wrong with it. You know, we always say what I'm just trying to clear the clouds here. I'm trying to walk smoke. There's a lot of smoke.
Yes, there was a lot of it that I heard mainly was because of the fact that they were sex abused. I never really heard a reason why. As to why my great-great-grandfather sexually abused his daughters or anything like that. But everyone after I did hear, that's why. When my abuser was in prison, I actually wrote him a letter. And I asked him why, did he do the things that he did to me. And he told me that it happened to him before he came and lived with us because he was a child as well. When it first started out at the time, you know, he's about 6-7 years older than me. I got a chance to be able to ask him, and he told me that it happened to him. So everyone that I've heard from that second to the fifth generation is that's the excuse that they used or the justification that they used.
Okay. Gotcha. Is, from your book, from the way you wrote your book, what do you want the audience to get, the reader to get from that book? What do you want them to be able to take away from you telling your story?
I would say from most of the people that I've seen to be my audience are those who kind of have experienced the same thing. And there's more to the book than sexual assault. And I guess I would more so say I would want them to get that there is some level of healing that can be done, and that they're not the only one. And so really open up the eyes of the things that I believe that for generations have been swept under the rug. And that's, you know, even if it isn't sexual assault, if it's, you know, addiction or, you know, alcoholism, whatever it is. My book talks about so many different things that I believe, you know, so many different curses and things like that happen in the family. So I would say a level of healing and understanding how or where it might have come from.
Okay. You are listening to the Black Reality Think Tank. I am your host, William Rogers. Our program topic today is sexual abuse and the black family. And my guest is A Sister Story, Miss A Sister Story. And she has written a book around the issue of sexual abuse based on her own experiences. And she has done this for healing reasons for herself, as well as to get the information out to those who are looking to heal. So if you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling area code 215-490-9832. I repeat, 215-490-9832. And you will come on the board, and I will see you, and I'll be glad to have you join the conversation if you have a question or you would like to make a comment. We definitely welcome you to do that. Miss Story, what did the book, in writing this book, what did it help you do?
In writing the book, it just gave me a clear level of understanding of what happened. Because, like I said, I was told for so long that the events that took place in my own personal life with my own trauma were not true. And it helped me be able to see, and it helped me be able to understand why my family acted the way that they did toward the situation and their background of where they came from and what their justification may have been to why things took place.
Okay. So you've been able to, you know, like I said, heal yourself, and, you know, you've kind of been able to understand a little bit about, you know, the family. Let me ask you, outsider looking in, I'm talking as an outsider looking in, is there any room in any of this for forgiveness?
There is.
Okay. And how would that take
place? I think it's the only way that a person will be able to heal and actually be able to get past it. Like I said, I struggled a lot with, you know, mentally with dealing with the trauma.
Okay.
And I believe that if you don't forgive the people who offended you or, you know, the person who caused the trauma or whatever, you know, the case may be, that you're never really going to be able to be free.
Okay.
So if you're never really able to be free and to forgive, then you're never going to be able to move on and move on with your life and, you know, fulfill your purpose and do what it is that you need to do.
How would that look? What would that look like, a process of to begin to forgive and heal? What would need to happen from your perspective?
You know, I would say, a person would need to forgive themselves first.
Okay.
I know that with me, with victimization, it, you know, I always felt like, oh my gosh, it's your fault. You know, if you would have done this, if you would have screamed, or if you would have fought, or, you know, something like that, I had to forgive myself first. And once I began to be able to forgive myself, then I could forgive everybody else that was around me and then forgive the person who actually caused the trauma.
Okay.
So I would say the beginning parts of the healing process will be able to start to forgive yourself and to know that, you know, it's, you know, it wasn't your fault, or, you know, find some type of coping. I would say therapy, which therapy was my number one thing, to be honest. I went to therapy, and I still have to be able to forgive myself first to even be able to go to therapy and be able to talk to someone else and get their perspective and that help that I needed.
Okay. All right. Sexual abuse in the black family. That's what we're talking about this evening. We do have a caller from Birmingham, Alabama. I don't know if the caller wants to talk or they're just listening. Good afternoon. Good evening, caller. Are you interested in asking a question?
This is Renaya Howard. I was calling. Yes, I don't have a question, but I do have a comment.
Okay, please go right ahead.
Okay, my comment is, I understand and I totally agree with the sister story with knowing how to build up the strength to seek counsel or get healing, because every day is a different struggle within, like, even within task making or trying to deal with functioning inside a society as far as social interactions. Well, the people, you just, like, you can't trust anyone. You're constantly trying to figure out what's your next move, or even with minor things like dealing with someone, cooking, cleaning, your attention span is so short, and you don't know who to trust. You don't know who to trust because of going through such a situation as such. And I just want to say I understand clearly what our sister story is saying, because I can relate a whole lot about the sexual abuse within the family and also outside of the family.
Right.
And it's difficult, but the main source of strength is having the Most High God in your life. Without the Most High God being in your life, and without you digesting the word and living all up to that purpose, then we cannot move on. We can't move on. We can't forgive each other. We're supposed to forgive each other.
Right.
And it's stated that inside biblically that we're supposed to forgive each other, no matter how hard the situation may be. And that's where your strength really lies at the end of the day. And I'm also calling because I want to shout a sister story out. I'm also her co-marketing and advertising manager.
Beautiful.
Over her clothing my company. So I'm supporting my sister.
Fantastic. Why don't you tell the audience again how they can get a copy of the book from your marketing, advertising position?
Well, just as she said, you can order it off of Amazon.com.
Okay.
Go to Google or Play Store and download the app.
Okay.
Or if your phone is already equipped to it, you know, just get a book that way, and then you can enter it.
Okay. All right.
Get the book off of Facebook. We can send it to your Facebook.
Okay, though. All right. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. Miss Story, is the book on Kindle? Can you get it on Kindle?
It is on Kindle. Yes, it is.
Oh, wonderful. Great. Let me ask you, and then I want to bring on our therapist expert. But let me just ask you this question before I do. How does all of this affect the way you saw yourself as a young woman? Coming up as a teenager, you know, attracting sometimes, you know, obviously in the male-female realm of things, you know. Like, for instance, your interest in courting men or trying to make yourself presentable so men would like you. Did that steal that from you?
It did. I'm currently married now. I've been married for going on 4 years.
Okay.
And it's been a struggle. You know, there's a period of time that I wasn't able to be intimate with my husband because of the fact that I was sexually abused.
Okay.
And even though I knew it wasn't him, you know, it still was, you know, hard to, you know, even to give him a kiss or to get a hug or, you know, just to play around or for that any type of affection, because I would just feel like I would just go into these panic attacks, or I would just, you know, get so afraid, and I would just, you know, lay there or be, you know, really still, and because my mind would take me back to that place. And even though I knew, you know, that he wasn't the person that did that, it did take that from me. It did take away from me being able to even look at men, me being attracted to men. Or anything like that. It did. It most definitely took that away. And like I said, I've been married almost 4 years. And I say about 3 of those years, It was hard. It was hard to be intimate with my husband or anything else like that.
That's powerful. Okay. Sister Bonisa Young. Good afternoon, Miss Young. Miss Young?
I'm here.
Yes. Can you hear me?
Oh, now I can. Uh-huh.
Hey, Dr. Rogers, how are you?
I'm wonderful. Good. How are you doing?
I'm all right. I'm all right. And how's the young lady? What is your name again, please? Because there was some background noise.
Sister Story.
Sister Story?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you so much for writing the book and sharing, you know, honestly. That's huge. That's huge. Because as I think we all know, so much of this stuff has been kept secret in the Black community for decades, actually centuries. So I'm glad that we're in an era now where people, women and men, are beginning to speak out and tell.
I agree. I totally agree.
Yeah. So is there a specific question that you asked me, Doc? I wanted to greet everyone first.
Let's talk a little bit about Ms. Story and I kind of broached the subject about the causation of this. What causes a family to launch out and do this and begin? Because she said that drugs and alcohol was not a part of that. A lot of it has the ones that were doing the abusing were also abused themselves. But and we know how that sometimes works. But from your perspective of therapy and counseling, what causes that? Is it the culture that we live in? Is it some other things that are happening? Mrs. Story felt that she looked at it from a spiritual realm. It's a spiritual problem. But I think if we're going to talk about healing, you got to talk about causation. And that's what I'm asking. What is the causation from your perspective?
Well, the cause for most of our acting out, whether it's addiction, whether it's violence, domestic violence, rape, sodomy, you know, all of those ways that we do violence toward each other and torment each other is rooted. Now, the causation is rooted in our experience in Black people's experience in America. Mm-hmm. Okay. We have been so terrorized for 400 years, and it's never stopped, mm-hmm. That we started feeling a sense of powerlessness over time. Because every time we tried to fight white supremacy, and when I talk about white supremacy and terrorism, I'm talking about slavery, you know, I don't even think that a lot of young people can imagine what it's like to be owned by somebody. And your every move is monitored, and you're whipped, and your body parts are cut off. I think it's hard for a lot of people to imagine that. Then you move on to Jim Crow, where our men were lynched as sport, you know, or the law was taken into European white people took the law into their own hands and just tortured our men and women and whole families, mm-hmm. you know, hung, burned alive. We've gone through so much hell that it's caused a sense of powerlessness. Every time we tried to stand up and build towns or whatnot, everything was destroyed that we built. A man could not be a man. Mm-hmm. He was controlled by another man. That's why especially during Jim Crow, our Black men were called boys. So the feelings of powerlessness, plus all of the hurt, plus all of the rage and the shame and the guilt, all of those feelings begin to have a cumulative effect. And the unfortunate and terrible thing is that we begin to act out on each other.
Yes.
I can't beat this white man back up when he's beating me up. You know, I can't do anything about my condition. So you're standing next to me and you're my woman or you're my child. So I'm going to beat you or I'm going to rape you. Mm-hmm. And that is, unfortunately, that's our history. And I also, just in a short, you know, a couple of paragraphs, but I also want to quickly go to indigenous community. Indigenous, in many indigenous communities, I'm trying to think of some, let's say, indigenous Indians that were here before Europeans invaded. Many places in Africa, you know, in Australia, before Europeans invaded those areas, those nations and those countries, there was no such thing as child abuse like this or incest like this. Mm-hmm. It did not exist. There are cultures where right now, in hot climates, children walk around naked. Women are half naked. You know, their buttocks are out. Their breasts are out. There are no rapes. Mm-hmm. So women and children are not raped and molested. And several, all over the world, in indigenous communities. Mm-hmm. So we got to ask ourselves, what's different between America, what's happening here with all of the levels of sexual abuse and whatnot, in other places? That means something is wrong here in America. You all follow me so far?
Oh, yeah, very clearly.
That means that something is wrong. To give you a quick example, I've talked about a book by Maladoma Somme. He's out of West Africa, and he talks about growing up as a child and how as a child he would go missing for 3 days, and his parents would not know where he was. Mm-hmm. But his parents did not worry. 3 days this child was missing. You know why they didn't worry? Because they knew that another family was feeding and caring for and loving that child. And the molestation and all this stuff didn't exist. And this is in the early 1960s. You mm-hmm. see, so there are cultures that don't have this sickness. So getting back to the terrorism that we've experienced, again, it's so unfortunate that we take our pain out on other people. And, you know, if you could think, anybody could think about, you know, have you ever gotten angry, so angry that you just kick the wall? Or if you have a pet, you just kick the dog or the cat or something like that.
Right, right.
Can anybody relate to that?
Oh, yeah.
Hello?
Yeah, I said, oh, yeah.
Yes. Uh-huh. Okay, all right. So that's us. And just multiply that like 1,000 times. You know, we got so angry, started doing these things to each other. And so that is the cause. Most of what we have going on in our communities now in terms of, you know, these awful things that I talked about, domestic violence, rape, you know, and molestation, whatnot, are a direct result of our oppression here in America.
Right. And you know, I think you hit it right on the head. I really do believe, you know, from that position, that is the case. Because one of the things I know we talk about a lot is the disrespect sometimes that men have, particularly African men, have for their women. The fact that we pimp them, we put mm-hmm. them on poles and have them dance for white men or anybody, put money down their G-string. Those are forms mm-hmm. of serious disrespect. Mm-hmm. And that athlete obviously has to come because you don't see them as somebody, you know, that you want to respect. Because I think in other cultures, I can't see, like you said, in the Native American culture, them pimping their women or having them dance on poles.
No, not at all.
I can't see that. So there has to be some... distaste. But then also I've gotta say this, and I'm kinda like Miss Story, you know, you get confused. I'm a father. I have three daughters. And they're all grown, two are deceased, one's still living. And I remember when they were growing up, they were very healthy young ladies. They were full figured. They were full-figured ladies, and but never, ever, ever.
You're picking up a little dark.
Yeah, I know. We're having some difficulty. I know this. It's the internet. I think the weather's real bad in some up in these parts. But anyway, I think that never ever did I ever look at them in any kind of a sensual, sexual way. Never. If anything, it was the complete opposite. You know,
mm-hmm.
I used to get annoyed about them when they came out of the room not dressed properly. I said, don't be walking mm-hmm. around here like that. What's wrong with you? You know, I would take that role, but never, mm-hmm. ever, never, ever look at that. So, and I came through the same system that you're talking about. I lived in the South. You know, I knew, you know, a lot of the things. But what happened? I mean, what is the difference then with that? Is that a psychological piece? Is it that the mind has to be trained not to? Well, I don't know. I'm just, like I said, I'm confused. So I'm rambling about it. So, but as a therapist and a specialist, how do I explain that?
Well, you know, people react differently to trauma and abuse.
Okay.
You know, many absorb the behaviors of the predator, and some go the opposite way.
Okay.
You know, so you can have two children, say for instance, being raised in the same family. Say for instance, Michael Eric Dyson. He is, as we know, a brilliant scholar.
Right.
You know, the man is so well known. He's articulate. He's just a genius.
Right.
And he speaks out for black folk, you know, and all folk for justice and against oppression. And he's extremely successful. His brother, on the other hand, is in prison for I don't know how many years. I think he's been in prison for 20 years or something like
that. Right, I've heard that, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, raised by the same family.
Right.
So two different ways.
Okay.
So
I see.
So
good
everybody
point.
Does not react to
good
trauma
point.
and oppression in the same way, but there's always an impact. I'll say that.
That's
there's
good
always
point.
An impact. And I want to also address the family situation, because family behaviors, and this is very important for survivors of sexual abuse to understand, family behaviors are passed down generationally, not from a spiritual curse, but from a pattern of behavior curse. See, so if grandfather raped, you know, his daughter or a son or whatever, the behavior pattern is going to be passed down. And that's why I said it's literally a programming, you know. So yeah, the rapes, you know, the sexual acting out and abuses becomes a programming, and the family just starts taking on that programming. And we know it's very easy to program people, right? I'll use Hitler because, you know, most people know about Hitler, how he easily programmed Germans to just kill off a whole bunch of Jews.
Right.
You know, Jim Jones. Jim Jones, he programmed these people to the point where they committed suicide.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them willingly committed suicide.
Mm-hmm.
Others in the same commune tried to get away. You see how the trauma and craziness affects people in different ways.
Right.
But I want to make very clear, it's the behavior that is a generational curse, not necessarily a spiritual generational curse.
I got you. Ms. Story, I'm going to take a break, Ms. Story, top of the hour break. When I come back, I'm going to ask you some questions so you can get prepared for this. That's why I'm telling you. I want to ask you a question about the vividness in which you wrote your book. Explain
okay.
it a little bit about, and you and I had talked about it before, but what why was that necessary, and what is it that you were trying to make in doing that and making it very vivid as you did? When we come back from our break, we definitely want to take that, ask that question. So let's take a quick break at the top of the hour. We'll be right back.
All right.
Ain't got no home, ain't got no shoes, ain't got no money, ain't got no class, ain't got no skirts, ain't got no sweaters, ain't got no perfume, ain't got no love, ain't got no faith.
ain't got no culture, ain't got no mother, ain't got no father, ain't got no brother, ain't got no children, ain't got no aunts, ain't got no uncles, ain't got no love, ain't got no mind.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
To our listening audience, we have also other wonderful programs that air here on the Time for Awakening Network. We have a program that airs every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. called African Perspectives. And that program is hosted by Brother Oshi, Amy Adelabu. And that program airs every Monday, Wednesday, Friday from 11 to 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Again, it is called African Perspectives. African Perspective is a part of the Motherland Media Network, which also is the sponsor for this program here on the Time for an Awakening Network. So by all means, check him out. And then on Friday evenings from 7 o'clock to, I'm sorry, from 8 to 10, we have Time for an Awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. They're coming out of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and they're a wonderful program, discussion, dynamic guests. You get a chance to talk with some very outstanding individuals that we know, scholars, from around the globe. So that's every Friday from 8 to 10, and then again on Sunday from 7 to 10, Time for an Awakening airs as well. And so you be sure to just simply go to www.timeforanawakening.com, and you can listen that way, or you can listen via the telephone, which is area code 215-490-9832. As I said, the Black Reality Think Tank is every Tuesday from 8 to 10 here. And then again on Saturday from 4 to 6 p.m. on the Blog Talk Radio Network. You can simply go to the Black Reality Think Tank Facebook page and you can get the link and the information for upcoming shows and upcoming activities by simply looking at that. On Sunday, there is another program that airs on the Blog Talk system called Gospel Gold, and that is a program that talks about the history and the impact of gospel music in America, which is the African-American lifeblood. And that program is hosted by Reverend Michael Rogers, who is pastor of the Holly Springs Baptist Church out of Holly Springs, North Carolina. Very dynamic program that airs. And then that Saturday program of Black Reality Think Tank is hosted by two wonderful young ladies, Ms. Shani B. and Ms. Lady B. Dynamic discussions and conversations dealing with young people and how they see things. So we ask you to join all this network. This is a wonderful opportunity for us to talk as a community and dialogue and look at the various things that that are going on that we can try to see if we can make some kind of impact. And so here tonight we are looking at sexual abuse and the Black family. And we have a wonderful guest, very dynamic, brave young lady. I am so proud of her. I don't know what to do. She's brave and she's able to stand up and tell her story. And we've got to do that. And joining her has been Ms. Bonisa Wayan, who is a regular part of the Black Reality Think Tank. And so we appreciate her input. So with that, Ms. Story, and then we're going to open up our lines. We have some other callers on and we're going to see if they would have comments. Okay, Ms. Story, in your book,
yes. You
have been very vivid. And one of the things that I think helped me understand the whole idea, I mean, we all know sexual abuse. We know that that's you're sexually abusing somebody. But I think in your story, you were specific about what sexual abuse really is. You want to tell us why you did that and just kind of explain that a little bit for us, help us understand that, because I think it really makes a strong point from my perspective as a reader, but just for our listening audience. So when they pick up that book and they start reading it, they'll see some stuff and they say, well, why did she write like that? You know, how would you answer that?
I think the story specifically that you're talking about is the molested uncle, generational curse of the molested uncle. And if I may speak of just based on that story alone, I think it's the one that I've gotten more of a response to because of the fact that I was so raw and uncut with that story. Part of the reason why is because the story is, like I said, everything is true. It's a true story. The reason why I write the way that I do, so raw and uncut and vivid, is because I want the reader to be able to truly understand and grasp beyond the fact of just sexual assault. Like, when we say sexual assault, you automatically think somebody, you know, just got raped or molested. But not that it's a good thing or to glorify it. No one, it's never really talked about of what's considered sexual assault or what was actually done. So I think for them to hear someone tell their story and tell their story as it happened and the truth about what was actually done, I believe that it would give them a better understanding of sexual assault, okay, and the things that may have taken place, and be able to see from the person who was the victim, to be able to kind of sympathize with them and see, you know, more so where it came from and where they were coming from. during that time and that place when they were there.
Okay. So, in other words, it's just you want to make sure that they know it's just not mere where somebody is touching you inappropriately in the wrong place, you know, or doing that or feeling on you or something like that as a woman, that this there's depth to this. Is that correct? Am I correct in saying that?
You're correct.
Right. Okay. So you wanted to make sure that the audience said that. And I've noticed that even in the Me Too movement, that seems to be an indication as well. They are becoming more graphic in describing what's going on. I listened to this woman, I think it was last night, describe what that guy from CBS used to do to her. She did this on television, and what she said he actually did. And so clearly you could see, you know, this ain't no joke. You know, this is real deal stuff here. So I think, okay, so you wanted to make sure you get that point out there. Can you, just for the sake of discussion, can maybe between you and Ms. Ayan define then for me what is sexual abuse? A working definition for us as we, you know, talk to others and as we maybe present other formats of programs where we can look at this as a healing kind of thing. What is that? What is sexual abuse? Are we misusing that word? Is that just too general a term? Do we need to go deeper and more specific?
I think I think it depends on the audience. I kind of think it depends on the audience as far as the going deeper.
Okay.
I do think that it's something that I think sexual abuse is very light, though. In general, I think it's very light. I think it just, you know, to me, when I think of sexual assault, you know, when I think of sexual abuse, I just think of somebody was touched the wrong way. Sexual assault, you know, I kind of think of it as rape. I don't really think of it as the way that I describe it in my book.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I think that the word is kind of a little light.
Okay. Ms. Ayan, what about you? Is sexual abuse too light of a word?
I think it's very general.
Okay.
And that's why a little earlier I used words like sodomy, rape. I think we have to call it what it is in whatever situation. So as this sister is saying, people can get the real deal about what actually happened, you know, to a person.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I think we should be as specific as possible.
Okay, good.
Because it's not a nice subject.
Right, no, it's not. And so, in other words, meaning that so when others need to tell their story, they can have a little of the confidence to get up and say exactly what happened to them. Did you do, were you graphic in that way? Miss Story, when you were trying to tell your mother and your parents, did you say specifically what was happening to you?
I actually was. I was.
Okay.
I didn't really, now looking back at it, I remember the first time I was about 5, and now thinking about it, I was pretty on point. So I was very, very graphic when I told my mother. My father wasn't around at the time. But when I told my mother, yeah, I was pretty graphic.
You graphic about that. And what was her response?
My mom's response was, I didn't know what I was talking about.
Okay.
And as I started to get older, I actually got whooping because of the things that I said. So her response was whooping me and that I didn't know what I was talking about and what happens in this house stays in this house. That's the response that I got.
Now, that's the one thing that I'm hearing, because we've had some other individuals that came on our program. We had a lady who has written a book. She's in Houston, Texas. Ms. Patterson, she had published a book about her sexual abuse. And we've had Dr. Belcher, Alice Belcher, who is also a therapist, and she talked about hers. And the one thread of inference that runs through all of this is that when you try to tell the authority person in your life, the mother, or if it was a grandmother, whatever, when they tried to do that, they all denied it and said that you didn't know what you were talking about. They don't do that. So I got to ask, what is that? Now, why, as women, you know, and the two of you are women, if a woman came to you and told you something like that, why would you tell her that you don't believe that she was saying that, that that's true? How would you structure that in your thinking to be able to, the first thing to do is deny it? Is it to protect the family? Is it to keep scandal out of the household? Is it to diminish the ramifications of that? Both of you, I'd like for both of you to answer that for me, Ms. Story and Ms. Ayan.
I would say that it's because I think that they really don't want to deal with it. More of a denial thing, more in denial of not wanting to deal with it, not really being able to kind of grasp, like, oh my gosh, look at what they just said to me, or, you know, look at what they said happened. That's what I would think.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm in agreement. It is actually, Doc, you mentioned the word protection of the family. It's protection of oneself. It's a very selfish response, because it's a response from a person who does not want to deal with a reality, a painful reality or a devastating reality that has just been put in their faces. Mm-hmm. I have seen it over and over, and I have to say this too. I want to say this. I have heard hundreds of these stories over the years, and every time I hear another story, it's just as devastating to me, you know? And so, sister, young lady, I really feel you. And when you talk about it starting at 4 or 5, my heart just breaks for you. No matter how many stories I hear, and I've heard some most horrific, you know, detailed stories, it's always devastating. And I also want to say that, you know, this is widespread. What Sister Story is talking about is widespread in the Black community. It's one of those secrets that so many Black women and men,
yes,
carry that's been swept under the rug. And, you know, it just devastates a person's life, the whole life.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's the person protecting themselves.
Okay.
They don't have any interest in protecting the child that's just been, and I call it also sexual violence, you know, violently abused sexually. They're protecting themselves.
Okay. Now, as you all were talking, I was thinking about it from the male perspective, and we have a couple of males online. I'm going to ask their perspective on that. If one of my daughters would have come to me and said that, I think that my approach would have been to immediately check it out. I definitely would not have denied it and say that she didn't know what she was talking about. I would, first I'd probably go to my wife, their mother, tell her, and say, let's take a trip. Let's go find this person and let's check this out, you know. And I would be definitely launched, probably to hurt somebody. And I'm not a violent person, but I can't fathom that. It had never happened. My daughters never came to me with that story. And, but it's a funny area. It's a funny area, and I know that I would respond differently and to do that. What do you think, Brother Griffin? As a father, how would you respond to that if your daughter came to you and said something?
First off, I'd like to say to the young lady, all the moral support I can give here online. I applaud your strength. keep going because it'll empower other people.
No doubt.
And I also, I didn't catch the names because I'm kind of working here in my shop. It's a hurricane coming here. But, you know, I gotta catch your program, Dr. Rogers. I got to get my fix. What I will say is I was a parent at a late age. I was almost 40 before I had my only child. But I had so many friends that raised children, and I'm pretty observant. So I was protective of my son, and he had a lot of friends in the neighborhood we lived in. There were an awful lot of white people. And so I was kind of like a neighborhood dad. I try to go through this quickly. And after, you know, all the kids, I would gather them on Saturday mornings when I wasn't working or Sundays, and also try to give the moms a day off. So I would have 6-7 kids running around our place. And there happened to be a couple of little girls that were touchy. I always wanted to sit in my lap. And being the male there, even though my son was there with a couple of other children, I just knew that something was wrong with that. So I had to bring all the women together and explain to them, look, this is not normal behavior. Something is wrong here. And it ended up one of the little girls was being sexually molested. So and my only thing is, I say to every parent, regardless of whether you trust somebody or not, it's your responsibility when you leave home to sometimes backtrack in 30 minutes or an hour or come back unexpectedly. It's your job to protect that child. And I agree with the expert that was talking, the doctor that came on later. Too many parents take it as an injustice on them and don't want to take the responsibility for protecting the child.
Right.
It's not about them once a child is molested. It's really not about them. Whether they were negligent, whether they were just too trustworthy, whatever it is, the bottom line is protecting that child so that they can grow up to be a functioning adult without a whole bunch of pain. And I'll yield the floor, but I'm proud of her. I love listening to her. And I think she's going to be all right as long as she stays steady with it. Trust yourself.
Right. Thank you,
Brother Kevin.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. My good friend, Brother Herbie White, your daughter came to you. What would you tell her? What would you do? What would you say?
Yes, good evening, Dr. Rogers, and to everyone on the show. I don't have any children.
Okay.
But I have nieces and nephews and like that. And where I grew up in Brooklyn on the streets with my friends and the people that we were close to, if somebody did something to you, had a problem with somebody, you came back and you got your crew and we went and we handled it. It's not something I'm proud of, but that's the way you did it.
That's right.
If somebody picked on you or whatever like that. So if we were willing to do that, I don't know what we would have did if we heard that somebody had molested a child.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Tell me about it. That's right.
It wouldn't have been good.
No, it wouldn't have been. It's like the quote from The Godfather, Lou Grabowski sleeps with the fishes. And it's that kind of action. But anyway, okay, great. Any other statement there, Brother Wayne?
Personally, it's something hard for me to even imagine somebody doing something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It to me, it's the most despicable thing a human being can do to another human being.
No doubt about it.
It's totally unacceptable. I can't even put it into words how I feel about that.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that I see, and it doesn't even involve me, but it raises my anger and my hatred, and you know, and it bothers me for days.
Mm-hmm.
It's just something that I just can't understand it.
Mm-hmm.
I just can't understand what's in the mind of somebody that does something like that.
Right.
But I know they don't need to be around.
Right. Mm. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Okay. All right. Thank you, Brother White. Let me shift gears a minute, ladies, and ask this question. The Me Too movement. There are a lot of people criticizing that movement, saying it's just a political thing, and you know, women trying to get paid, and you know, so forth and so on. Because you all are working in that area of sexual trauma and so forth, how would you respond to people that might say that the Me Too movement is too much? That's, I'm hearing too much. This is politics. You know, how do you all look at that? Either one can start off. Ms. Story, you want to start first? How do you see the Me Too movement?
On my end, it's kind of like a little bit of breaking up, so I couldn't really hear the question or what you said. It's kind of breaking up a little bit.
I was trying to shift gears a little bit and talk about the Me Too movement. That we're hearing a lot about that. It's causing a lot of men to fall from grace, and I'm wondering, how do you all see that? A lot of people criticize it as being too much, and it's just politics and, you know, feminist bashing and all that kind of stuff. So I want to ask you, how do you all see that? How do the two of you?
I'm not that familiar with it. I've heard about it. I actually know someone who did who attended an event that was surrounded by it.
Mm-hmm.
I can't speak on it too much because I'm not really that familiar with it.
Okay, but as a concept, do you think this can do some good in terms of ending this sexual abuse and sexual trauma? Can it affect some things, or is it just going to create more hostility?
I think that it can do some good after bringing it to light, more bringing it to light.
Okay. All right.
We're moving to the area.
Sister Yan, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that from what I observe, I actually watched the sister, the black woman, I don't recall her name, that started the movement.
Right.
I actually saw her on Black Girls Rock.
Okay.
And that was the first time I ever heard anything from her or saw her. And what she said was that she started the movement for women, but specifically for us, for black women.
Right.
And she said that white women hijacked what she was doing and took it someplace else.
Okay.
So white women hijacked it to add it to their women's, you know, whatever, feminist movement, and started doing stuff that the sister did not intend it for. So they white women politicized it, or the feminist movement, whatever, politicized it, and now they're doing all, you know, they're targeting any and everybody.
Right.
And so I don't trust that personally.
Okay.
I wouldn't support this politicized movement. But the idea of women speaking out and saying this happened to me is always good, and men, because I work with so many men that have been sodomized and molested.
Okay.
So that aspect is good from my perspective. But listening to the two brothers brought to memory two things, two short pieces I want to share with you. Okay, Doc?
Yeah, no, go right ahead.
Okay. So the first thing is that I have an aunt that is 85. I think she's 85 now. And she is one of the few of her generation that will talk about these things like molestation and sexual violence and whatnot. For everyone else in that generation, it was hush, hush, don't say anything. And so I get a lot of family history from her. And she just recently, after all these years, and I'm in my, you know, I'm just 60, just 61. I found out that one of my uncles was sexually abused. Was sodomized, and by several people, but primarily by a pastor in Baltimore, who later on people found out that he had sodomized a lot of the little boys in the church, and resulting in those same boys becoming homosexual.
Hmm.
That had been swept under the rug for decades. And my aunt just told me about it, and it just blew me away.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to share that, because we've got to pay attention to what's happening in our churches. There are people that are becoming ministers and pastors who are mimicking that Catholic, you know, sodomy. And we got to start calling this stuff out in this generation, in our communities. And the other thing is that when I was younger, there was an attempt to molest me. I was 5 years old, and a guy grabbed me. We used to play under the stairs in Brooklyn, and a guy grabbed me, a man. He probably was in his, 40s or 50s or something like that, and he started telling me to stick my tongue in his mouth. And he wouldn't let me go. So I started squirming and, you know, and whatnot. And not to go into a lot of detail, but I was able to escape from him and run into my apartment, which was down the hall. But as I ran into my apartment, I saw the man go into another apartment down the hall in the opposite direction. Now, I had a father who loved me. Mm-hmm. I had a wonderful Black father. And so I immediately told my father when he came home from work. And this was my father's response. He looked at me and he said, "I'm going off." He used to not say, "I'm going out," but he said, "I'm going off." You know, coming from the South, he said, "I'm going off. I want you to stay in this house, and don't you dare open the door, and don't you dare leave this apartment." Mm-hmm. And he was dead serious. So I was just rooted to where I was. And he walked out the door. And he came back. I don't remember. It was so long ago. But he came back, and I never saw that man again. Mm. Okay. My father's transitioned, so I can tell the story now. But I believe that he took care of that man. Mm. And so, yeah. After hearing the brothers talk about that we handled those things back in the day.
That's right. You sure did.
I have to say, you want to say something?
No, I'm amening what you're saying.
Yeah, we handled that back in the day. We have a dangerous situation now where we're teaching our people this culture of being politically correct, you know, and being polite, and how do I want to say this? Saying that every bad thing, and I'm not saying this at all to the sister, young lady, I'm not saying it to you at all, but I watch our communities say that everything is spiritual or the devil, and it is not. Because when we do that, we don't take responsibility and handle our business. Mm-hmm. We need to handle people that abuse and do violence toward our children.
That's right.
And with our fathers being snatched out of communities and mass incarcerated, and with all the sickness that's in our communities, we no longer have those men that will stand up and say, "Oh no, you're not going to do this to somebody in my community." Mm-hmm. So now the women, we've got to stand up and we've got to fight back. I'm a believer in fighting back. My family has always fought back. My mother's side. And so there are certain problems. Once you did something, you wouldn't do it anymore.
Exactly.
So we've got to start fighting back. We've got to organize. We've got to do things and not just be victims and try to pray it away because it's not going away.
I agree. Brother Griffin, you had a point you wanted to make?
Oh, I just wanted to put that name in there, Dorana Burke, that the young lady talked about. She was actually from Selma, Alabama, and interestingly enough, I just listened to a podcast where I found out when Melissa Milano didn't give credit to her. Once she found out who she was, she tried to get Tarana Burke to go to that celebrity thing that Oprah and them were all involved in. And what Burke did was call around to five other women minorities, and one of them was a Black Latino by the name of Rosa Clemente. And I just heard her tell the story that rather than go and walk the one way by herself, Tarana Burke said it wasn't really about her. It's about empowering other women.
Right.
And she has a book coming out in 2019 talking about her foundation and what it's all about. And I think it's called Where the Light Enters, the founding of the Me Too movement.
Right.
So I just wanted to get that shout out since I know your audience is listening. Okay. Burke is a really, really talented sister. She started that movement back in 1997, long before there were hashtags.
Right, right. And you know, the real historical background of the Me Too movement started with Rosa Parks.
Yes.
In Selma, Alabama. Uh-huh. She even started that before she got involved in the Montgomery bus boycott. That's how she got to work with the NAACP, because she wanted to get women to stand up and tell their story about the rape and abuse that they were receiving by white men in Alabama. And that's where that really got its beginning from. And so this has been an ongoing issue, as I said before, you know.
I think you brought that up with Racy Taylor. I told you the Danielle McGuire is the lady who wrote that. You had a program a couple months ago on that. Remember, we talked about it when Oprah brought up Racy Taylor. But Burke also says that was one of her heroes, too. And it's interesting that she's from Selma, Alabama.
Right. That's it. That's exactly right. Yep. Miss Story, and again, this might be an area you don't want to deal with, but I would be interested, based on all of this things that you have had to work and develop, has this made you take a unique kind of philosophy and technique in raising your own children?
It has, actually. So my son, as I stated before, was conceived through the sexual assault. And it helped me be more aware and so cautious of the people he's around, mainly and surrounded by. And, you know, when it comes to listening to him and really paying attention to the things that he cares about or how he feels or about situations. And, you know, he gets a little upset with me at times because I'm like, you know, when, you know, I won't allow him to go to people's house if I have not met their parents or been in the house.
Right.
And I always have that fear, you know, at the age, my son is 12. So I had him when I was 13. I'm 25 now. He's 12. And, you know, because at his age, I was pregnant. So I don't remember what it was like to be to even have a childhood or to be a kid. So, you know, whenever he comes home, you know, I would always be, like, checking up on him and checking him and, you know, what did you do over there? Did they sit close to you? What kind of games did they play? You know, were there, how many other kids were there? You know, and I would make it perfectly clear what sexual assault was. And it kind of hurt my feelings because I would, you know, would be like, he's too young or, you know, he may not understand. And he understands. And as a mother, it was very hard for me to have to go there and take it as far as I believe that I had to take it in order to protect him.
Right.
So it did help me be very, very, very cautious and aware. And I tried to be the parent that I wish that my mother was that and who I needed at the time.
Right. Powerful. You know, we probably don't have enough time to talk about this now and go into the depth that I think it would need to go into. But I wanted to just ask Ms. Ayan, do we really see a lot of sexual mores and sexual laws and sexual practices are done out of culture and society? A lot of that's established from religion, set the rules for that. But sex is a natural activity or function of being a human being on the planet Earth. I would think that you gotta start there first. I mean, sex is not dirty. Now, society will paint that picture sometimes that it is dirty, and through religion has often used that. Do we need to, the question I have, Mr. Young, do we need to reevaluate how we teach our young people about sex? I was taught that it was bad. And I knew what they were doing. Obviously, over the years, my parents were trying to, you know, protect. And I understand that. But do we need to do an evaluation system on what is it and how we are teaching sex and the whole idea of sexology? Because it is real, you know, when it's not going anywhere. You can't kill it. You can't stop it. You can't say no, you know, because it's a natural function of the human body. So how do you think? How do you see that?
We absolutely have to have a, I wouldn't say a paradigm shift. I would say go back to indigenous cultures. Because as I study indigenous cultures, they're a great frame of reference of what humanity is at its best.
Right.
Sexuality in some indigenous cultures, because, you know, as you said, different cultures are, have, you know, different issues. But there are some cultures that do make it very clear, you know, this is natural, this is beautiful, this is a vagina, this is a penis, and it's not an issue. This is how God made us.
Right.
You know, this is how the Creator created us.
Right.
And actually, let me just be very clear. One culture that I studied teaches that way because, again, you know, they vary. But we should teach the truth, which is that it is beautiful and it is natural. Mm-hmm. And however, when you attack someone sexually, especially a child, then you need to suffer the consequences because that's indicative of a sickness.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. With a child or an animal. And, you know, speaking of culture, the cultural piece is so incredibly important because this culture that we're in, one of the reasons that this culture is so full of sexual predatory behavior mm-hmm. and all this craziness, polysexual and all this stuff, is because this culture sexualizes
everything.
Everything. And then objectifies and commodifies everything.
You put a naked woman.
And it is allowed. No matter how much people speak out, they do it.
Yes,
and I need to mention this. The organization NAMBLA, I didn't think that was an actual organization. It's an actual organization that promotes pedophilia.
Yeah. That's right.
And the latest DSM book, the DSM-5 or 6, whichever edition it is, has what my understanding is that they've taken pedophilia out of that book. It's a diagnostic manual for disorders, mental disorders. Mm-hmm. They've taken pedophilia out of that manual as a mental illness, and they're trying to, what's the word I'm looking for? Make it something common. They're trying to normalize it now. Mm-hmm. They have these people hold meetings promoting having sex with children. Mm-hmm. So as Black folk, we have to move away from this culture psychologically because it's sick and it's getting sicker.
Okay.
And we get sicker along with it. That's one of the reasons we have such widespread pedophilia in our communities because, again, that's not something that we've done traditionally.
That's right.
Before slavery.
Okay. Miss Story, why don't you, we've only got about 5 or 6 minutes left. Why don't you kind of let the audience know, for those who basically may have some things that they want to say but they're afraid to say or tell, or if there are some young people or people who might be working with young people. What parting words would you like to leave as a source of instruction, so that folk won't have to go through this pain at the levels that, you know, we are hearing and seeing, that they can begin to work and heal from it? What do you want to say to them?
I would say try to seek some type of therapeutic help off that. I think that if I would have grown up in a household to where therapy, I think that a lot of Black households, therapy isn't really something that's like your number one go-to. I would say try to seek some therapeutic help because for me it has been the number one thing that has helped, that in receiving counsel. And I think that would be that kind of really it would be to seek some type of therapeutic help, because it's kind of hard to process it on your own and by yourself. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times, you know, a lot of people suffer depression and other types of mental illnesses because of that type of trauma. So a lot of times it may have an effect on your judgment. So your judgment and the decisions that you make may not be the best decisions that you probably could make. Or you may need a little bit more help. You may got it a little bit, but you need a little bit more help. So I would say seek some type of therapeutic help.
And then, in sort of like a closing factor, what would you say to the abuser, someone who may be listening that is an abuser, maybe they want to stop, maybe they can't stop, whatever the case may be, what would you say to them at this point?
I don't want to get teary-eyed.
Okay, I
would say that it goes beyond someone being abused. Sexually goes beyond. It goes beyond just the touching and the rubbing and, you know, things like that. That child, you know, at a young age, that their innocence has been taken away from them. So it has no longer,
Okay.
It has no longer been able to be a choice for that child.
Gotcha.
So I would say that during that time in that state of mind, that you have to actually consider what you might be doing to that child and who they may become. Because there are men, you know, as well as women who turn to sexuality. There are people who commit suicide.
Mm-hmm.
There are people who become alcoholics or drug addicts.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the reality of that type of abuse for a majority of the people who have suffered that type of trauma. Me have been a stem and a branch off of sexual abuse and have dabbled into some of those things myself.
Right.
And so I would just say that there it's more than their innocence that's being taken away from that child, being
okay.
taken away from them.
Well, Ms. Story, I want to tell you that I love you for your strength and what you have done, the contribution that you've made to try to bring closure to this in your own life, as well as to try to direct others who may be going through this. I really, really, really applaud you. And I admire you for the strength to do that. I'm not quite sure that I don't know if I got that kind of strength, but you have really shown us something here this evening. I appreciate you. You know I'm going to be talking to you more. Her book, give us your name of your book once more, and you can purchase it at Amazon. It's also on Kindle, and you can purchase it directly
Correct.
From her. So give us the name once more for our audience who might have tuned in late.
Generational Curses, the 70 Years of Destruction of a Black American Family,
right.
Generational mm-hmm. Curses.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, ladies and gentlemen, our listening audience, Sister Bayan, Sister Brother Griffin, Brother White, for what you've done, for what you said.
Really quick.
We appreciate it.
Do I have 30 seconds?
No, I'm sorry. I got it. It's getting right at the end. It's going to cut off on us. I just want, because I need to close out with the announcement. So I thank all of you for listening on Saturday at the Black Reality Think Tank. We'll be on again at 4 o'clock with Shani B and Lady V, as well as Sister Boyan. I don't know, are you on this weekend as well, Sister Boyan? Yeah?
Likely not.
Okay. All right. Well, and you can go to our Facebook page at the Black Reality Think Tank. And you can get the link to log in and listen. And then our other programs, African Perspective, Time for an Awakening, you can also get those here. All of our programs are archived as well, too. This particular broadcast will be on the archive site, say, in about 2 to 3 days. So anybody can go back and listen to it again and pass it on to others that, you know, it may help. So we thank you. Have a wonderful and blessed week. And we will see you again next Tuesday here at the Black Reality Think Tank.
Don't know why. There's no sun up in the sky. Stormy weather. Since my man and I ain't together, keeps raining all the time. Life is bare, gloom and misery everywhere, stormy weather. Just can't get my poor self together. I'm weary all the time. The time. So weary all the time.